Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega.
No hate, no fear. Refugees are welcome here. No hate, no fear.
It's been 2 years since President Trump issued an executive order blocking entry to people from several Muslim-majority countries. The announcement brought protests at airports across the country and a slew of lawsuits. Back in June, the Supreme Court upheld a slightly modified version of that ban, and in his majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts cited the robust waiver process that was built into the ban. Theoretically, that would allow would-be immigrants to qualify for entry if they met certain criteria. But in the months since, many people who've applied for waivers say they're unsure what those criteria are, and they're still unable to bring their loved ones to the United States. In July 2018, a class action lawsuit was filed against the Trump administration, calling the waiver process inconsistent and arbitrary.
My name is Ismail Ahmed Al-Jazawi. I'm 25 years old. I'm from Yemen, and I'm a U.S. citizen.
Ismail is one of those plaintiffs. He's married to a Yemeni woman named Hind, and he's tried sponsoring her for a visa to immigrate to the United States. The couple fled the Yemeni civil war at the end of 2017. Last January, they managed a difficult journey to the nearest U.S. embassy in Djibouti for Hind's visa interview.
We went to the U.S. embassy, and it didn't take only like 5 minutes for the interview. They asked us a simple question, do you guys meet each other? It was just quick questions, like 5 minutes, and they gave my wife the refusal paper. What she mean is refused. Her case is refused under Section 212F, because it's Muslim ban.
The United States denied Hind a visa at a critical moment for their family.
A month after the interview, that's when my wife gave birth. We were struggling, facing a hard time. No income. I was borrowing money from family, friends to cover our expense. And it was very hot. And Djibouti is a place where you don't want to be at because life is hard over there. Everything's expensive, rent, electrical.
Even before their son was born, Ismail and Hind had planned to build a life together in the U.S.
So I wanted to bring my wife with me to the United States because she wanted to continue school and stuff. She wanted to be an RN. We have dreams and we can't live separate from each other. Plus, Yemen is a war and there is a lot going on there.
Like many other in Ismail's position, he and his family have hung their hopes on moving to the United States, but this time on a waiver.
I actually contacted the U.S. Embassy. I sent them a letter, explained everything that I was going through, and I sent them, asking them, please, give me the waiver program. Do something. Do your best for me. They sent me a letter. They said, we understand what you're going through, but that is a necessary process that your case going through right now, and we don't know how long this process will take.
As months went by, the situation for the family was becoming desperate. The only solution they saw was for Ismail to return to the U.S. to work, meaning that Hind and their baby would be forced to return to Yemen.
I didn't even want to send them back home, but I have no choice. I have to put them on a plane, going back home to Yemen, the worst place. I end up coming back to the United States from my job. After they got in Yemen, 2 weeks later, I was calling them, trying to contact them, make sure they're all right. And the first thing I heard my wife saying, there is no baby food, any supermarket or any store you go.
For now, they wait for an answer to their waiver request.
They said it'll take several weeks, and it's been months and months. I haven't received nothing. Since August, I haven't heard anything at all.
Faiza Patel has been following the implementation of the ban since its inception. She's the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center. Faiza, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be here.
So can you give us a sense of how common stories like Ismail's are?
So we've certainly seen a number of people applying for waivers, which is the only way for people from the Muslim banned countries to actually get into the United States and reunite with family. And most of the time, there's no process in place in the consulates for actually applying for a waiver. And the rate at which waivers are granted is really, really small. The best number we have dates back to April of 2018, at which point 572 waivers had been granted out of a total of roughly 27,000 people who were eligible for waivers. So that's, you know, a rate of about 2%. So I think it's safe to assume that the overwhelming portion of the people who apply for waivers are being denied.
What are the criteria? Because we started this story talking about the fact that there seemed to be some confusion about what exactly the United States is looking for to allow people into the country. So is there any clarity around what that is?
So that's a huge problem for people. So according to the Muslim Ban Executive Order, the waiver process was sort of a safety valve, right? So that people who had real humanitarian needs would be allowed to come into the country. In fact, there has been no guidance issued by the government as to what actually constitutes the kind of circumstances that would allow an individual to be granted a waiver and allowed to come here. And what we've seen instead is some leaked documents, some Freedom of Information Law requests have come up with documents. And one of the things we do know is that conditions in your home country are not enough. Wanting to reunite with your family is not enough. What the government seems to be looking for is some kind of dire emergency. You know, we saw the case last week or so about this young mother who was kept away from her toddler who was dying in the United States. And even then, they didn't grant a waiver until there was a huge amount of press attention and public pressure. But those are the kind of life and death situations, it seems, that the government has been receptive to.
The couple that we talked about, Hind and Ismail, were fleeing the war in Yemen. Is that not considered dire enough?
Absolutely not. And you can see that even in our refugee numbers. You know, our refugee numbers are in the low hundreds from Syria at this point. Overall, Muslim refugees are down 90%. That's definitely not enough for this administration to let anybody into the country.
So we're going to play some tape for you from a couple, a married couple who we reached out to who are in Saudi Arabia. The couple is Sahar and Joshua. Sahar is originally from Yemen. Under this executive order, she's barred entry to the United States, even though her husband is a U.S. citizen. Joshua, her husband, says that an immigration official told him to apply for a waiver for his wife. And here's how Joshua explained the situation.
He said, well, the waiver is something that, you know, there's no formula where this document plus this document equals approval. It's just a case-by-case basis. But basically, you need to prove that if she doesn't get the visa, it would be undue hardship on her, undue hardship on you, and that she's not a national security risk. And I got together a lot of documents that showed that she actually has never lived in Yemen. And I tried to submit those, but they wouldn't accept those. So they took a very limited number of documents. And they said 4 to 8 weeks. I submitted that in September. I'm still waiting. So it's been almost 16 weeks now.
This is exactly the kinds of stories that we've heard. You know, no process, no clear rules about, you know, what actually counts. You know, no documentation that they consider necessary for these kinds of things. But I think the story also points up, you know, one of the most fundamental sort of logical flaws with the ban, right? So this gentleman's wife had never lived in Yemen, right? But she's being excluded because of her Yemeni passport on the theory that the Yemeni government is not providing the U.S. information about her. Now, the Yemeni government has no information about her other than the fact that she's a passport holder because this woman has lived somewhere else all her life. And this is very typical of the sort of logical fallacy that's at the heart of the ban.
Our first story that we heard, Ismail, he's mm-hmm. part of a class action lawsuit. I'm wondering, there are many legal challenges that have been raised. Do you expect any of those lawsuits to change the process, to move this process forward after, particularly in light of the Supreme Court's decision?
So I think there's two sets of cases that we really have to watch. So one is that most people assume that the overall challenge to the ban has finished after the Supreme Court decision, and that's actually not the case. The Supreme Court decision was on a preliminary injunction motion, right? It was lawyers running into court saying, stop this. This is illegal. This is unconstitutional. This is harming people. And the Supreme Court declined to let that injunction stay in place. That doesn't mean that the underlying case necessarily goes away. And the court actually remanded that case back down to the district court. So people who the Brennan Center is representing, as well as other plaintiffs, are now back in district court in Maryland challenging the ban and seeking to get information from the government that will allow us to demonstrate, as if more proof were needed, that this ban is actually based on religious animus and not national security concerns. So that's one set of lawsuits that's ongoing. The other set, as you referred to, is the class action that's been brought against the waiver scheme. Now, the waiver scheme is quite interesting because the government made a big deal of the waiver scheme when they were arguing for the legality of the ban and said, look, we're being humanitarian. This is showing you that, you know, we don't just want to keep people out because they're Muslim. And certainly the dissenting justices kind of pointed to the waiver scheme as a way to potentially push back against the ban. One of the things that has been alleged in this case, and I think that's a really powerful argument based on all the stories we're hearing, is that really this implementation of this waiver scheme is just arbitrary. And, you know, under our legal system, that's not permitted. And that, I think, is a very strong basis for that case to go ahead as well.
Well, the administration also cited in their execution of this ban, if you will, national security, as you mentioned. Have we seen any proof that this has actually helped the United States in a national security capacity?
Well, it was never about national security. And we had national security officials from across the political spectrum going back several administrations saying, this is not how you do national security, that nationality is not a proxy for somebody's riskiness in terms of terrorism. So I don't think we've seen any particular national security benefit. I don't know exactly how you would measure that, to tell you the truth, but it was always a fig leaf. And frankly, you know, this administration has taken the tendency to use national security as a cover for doing whatever it is you want to another extreme. But we should all remember that using national security as a fig leaf is an old and tried tradition.
Well, I think we also see that playing out here on our southern border. There's a lot of rhetoric around that. But I guess the question is really to show whether or not the administration's stated purpose for putting this out there has actually had yielded any results. And I'm not sure if that's actually happened. Is the travel ban in effect indefinitely?
Yes, it is in effect indefinitely. There is a process by which countries can go off the travel ban list. And we've seen Chad, for example, was removed from that list, although it was never very clear why it was on the list to begin with. So the travel ban is in effect indefinitely. And we've certainly seen the impacts of it, obviously the individual stories that we're hearing, but also in terms of the numbers. So, you know, even outside of the countries affected by the travel ban, from Muslim countries overall, we've seen a drop of about 30% in immigrant visas, a drop of about close to 20% in tourist visas. So certainly the country is closing to Muslims, whether it's through the Muslim ban or whether it's through, you know, other bureaucratic means for making it more difficult for people to get visas. All of these things are happening on the ground.
Faiza Patel is with the Brennan Center for Justice. Thank you.
Thank you.
When the government reopened yesterday, so did immigration courts. It's estimated that during the shutdown, more than 86,000 immigration hearings were canceled across the country. And that means the already extensive immigration backlog in the courts could get worse. WNYC reporter Beth Fertig visited the nation's busiest immigration court in Lower Manhattan to see how judges and attorneys are managing this new load of cases. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
So were all the immigration hearings canceled during the shutdown?
No. The courts continue to hear cases of people held in detention, but that's just a small fraction, you know, probably less than 10% of the total number of cases. Most people going to immigration court are not detained. They're just going to court on their own, and their dates have been scheduled years in advance. So it's a big deal when you cancel their cases.
So when you went down to court, what did it look like? What were the lines like?
It was actually totally normal day in immigration court in New York, although I heard Los Angeles, it was different. The head of the union that represents the immigration judges, she's seated in Los Angeles, and she told me that they had to cancel all the normal, like, procedural hearings on Monday because they didn't have staff working over the weekend to get all the documents ready. But in New York, they did. So what I saw was just a regular day in immigration court, people going for their procedural hearings where they're going to file more motions, and people also going for what you could call a trial. That's where, you know, you ask for asylum or some other way to stay in the United States, and you get a full-scale hearing. And those are the hearings that people are most worried about having been canceled, because those took years to schedule. And so out of the 86,000 or so cases, not all of them were these trials, but the trials are the ones that are now going to be bumped to the back of the line. And so in a very busy court like New York, where some judges are scheduling new trials in 2022, if your date in January got bumped, you're probably not going to get heard for another year or two or three.
So you spoke with attorneys who some of their clients had their cases canceled during the shutdown. What did they tell you about when those cases could be rescheduled?
Well, so I spoke to people who had clients with trials that were scheduled during, you know, late December, January, and they generally had people seeking two things, either asylum or what you call cancellation of removal. And that's when an immigrant has been here for a long time and has U.S. citizens who are dependent on them, like a spouse or a child. And so I spoke with a lawyer named Aaron Rivera-Julka, who's representing a father from El Salvador. And he has a child with diabetes who's dependent on him, an older child. The hearing got canceled on January 17th, and now he's very worried because that child is 20 years old.
That hearing was canceled, and to date, we don't have a new hearing. So we're concerned that we're not going to be able to get the case heard before the child turns 21 and is no longer a qualifying relative.
So it's difficult if you have a child who's dependent on you and is going to age out of the qualification. You're going to have to try to beg a judge to hear the case sooner so it still qualifies. So these are the hazards if you keep bumping these cases.
Is there any benefit to some of these cases being postponed?
Actually, there is, Tanzina. And sometimes the lawyers are a little sheepish about admitting this because they'll say, I have a client with a weak claim, and this lets them stay in the U.S. longer. If you've applied for asylum, you get work papers in the meantime. And so at least they can work. And that's something that President Trump has criticized and said people with bogus claims, they come here just so that they can work. But I also heard from people who said, because of the Trump administration, it's much harder right now to get asylum if you are a woman fleeing domestic violence or if you're fleeing gang violence, particularly in Central America. It's much, much harder to get asylum right now. So this is Sophia D. She has a few clients, actually, who fit in this bucket of trying to seek asylum. And she says there may be an upside if they wait.
It can't hurt. It can't be any worse than it is today with the case law. So I'm hopeful that, you know, maybe even a new administration, because this was, you know, under Trump. You know, it was Jeff Sessions was his hire. I think that they're targeting Central American immigrants. You're not seeing it happen in any other area of law.
So let's say there's a new president elected in 2020. The policies could change after that. And if these clients get hearings rescheduled for 2021, that could work in their favor.
Beth Fertig is a senior reporter covering immigration, courts, and legal affairs for WNYC. Thank you, Beth.
You're welcome.
President Trump's 2019 State of the Union address is back on the calendar. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi invited the president to deliver his remarks next Tuesday. But the speech was originally intended for tonight, before Pelosi withdrew the opportunity over disagreement around the government shutdown. It's the first time since 1986 that the State of the Union has been delayed.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd planned to speak to you tonight to report on the State of the Union. But the events of earlier today have led me to change those plans.
That postponement was for very different reasons.
Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger.
The president has a constitutional mandate to give the State of the Union address. Since FDR, a nationally broadcast State of the Union has been delivered at the beginning of the new year.
I have called for personal sacrifice. And I am assured of the willingness of almost all Americans to respond to that call.
So we want to know how important the State of the Union really is. And we asked our favorite pundits, you.
Hi, my name is Karen Dewey, and I'm from Newport, New Hampshire. And no, I do not think the State of the Union is necessary. It's become a political event.
Hi, this is Dave in Newark, Delaware. And for the first time in my adult, semi-politically aware life, I really don't give a hoot.
JP, La Jolla, California, the State of the Union is now promulgated via tweets.
Hi, my name's Amanda. I'm calling from Killingly, Connecticut. I think the State of the Union is really just a political soapbox that doesn't actually tell what the State of the Union is.
This is Jason Bennett from La Jolla, California, and I care about the State of the Union, but I still can't help but feel it's like watching a slow-motion car crash.
All right, so those are your thoughts on the State of the Union, and we have Julian Zelizer, professor at Princeton University and co-author of Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Julian, is the State of the Union even important anymore?
Absolutely. Even though it's now watched through a partisan prism, and even though many people will tune it out, I think any moment you can hear what the president has planned for the year and what the president is requesting from Congress, it's still something we don't want to get rid of, especially in an era when so many people are turned off from politics.
What is the point, if you will, of the State of the Union?
Well, the point is still to outline an agenda for the year. It's basically to show what kinds of requests a president is going to be making of Congress, and also to prioritize what are the major problems that an administration is going to be focused on. Obviously, the State of the Union we're about to see and hear will also be filled with partisan attacks and all kinds of disinformation. But in general, I still think there is value to having that message delivered. And a lot of people still watch it, even though it's not as many people as it used to be. We're talking tens of millions of people will be watching it and then reading and watching the news about it.
We do know that President Trump's last State of the Union got more than 40 million viewers there. So to your point, now we know that it was Thomas Jefferson who did away with the in-person addresses, opting to just write his State of the Union. When did we get back to live speech, not just televised, but giving that? And why did we do that?
Woodrow Wilson decides to bring it back in 1913, and he starts the tradition which lasts until this day, in which the president will deliver this to Congress. First goes on the radio in 1923, and it starts to be televised under President Harry Truman in 1947, and it becomes a primetime event under Lyndon Johnson in 1965. So the tradition of doing it in person has now been around for over a century. And as a televised event, it's really been going on since the advent of television.
Besides the politics and the border wall and everything else, the fight between Trump and Pelosi specifically over this State of the Union delivery, I mean, couldn't the president have given the State of the Union anywhere, from anywhere? Did it have to be where tradition has mandated so far?
Well, he still doesn't even have to give it. I mean, he could have broken with tradition or gone back to the pre-Wilson tradition and sent it in writing, but he doesn't want to do that. He could have given it as some kind of rally or some kind of Twitter feed State of the Union address, but I think he wants the presidential ceremony. He wants the pomp and circumstance of looking like a president. So there was part of him, even though he despises everything about Washington, who still wants to look presidential at this moment in front of the nation. So that's why I think he was determined to get this invitation back.
And he also, as you mentioned, wanted the spectacle of it all. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about how the technology has changed the State of the Union. You mentioned radio, then we shifted to television. In 1947 was the first time they televised the address, and we actually have a clip from that broadcast.
Mr. Truman confronts a Congress heavily weighted by the opposition. He delivers his message on the State of the Union.
In the effort to bring about a sound and equitable price structure, each group of our population has its own responsibility.
How did that change the nature of the State of the Union speech, Julian?
Well, the visuals become as important as what is actually said. The manner in which the president delivers the speech, the kind of gravitas that they display is important. The reaction of the members of Congress who are watching also becomes really important. During the 1980s, the parties start to coordinate when to applaud. Republicans are given a transcript of Reagan's speech. I think it was in 1982, where there's literally lines in terms of applaud here and show your support for the president. So all of that becomes more choreographed. Reagan in the 80s starts to invite guests and people who are notable, average citizens who are notable for doing something, and that usually plays into the ceremony. So it's really become a form of televised presidential spectacle. And the words themselves are only part of what people are looking for that evening.
And you mentioned the guests, and I think those guests can often be politicized itself. I feel like a lot of Americans, just from what we heard from our callers, are just really tired of it, of the politicization of this speech. The State of the Union so far is back on for next week. What does this mean politically for the president?
I don't think it's going to mean much for the president. I expect he's going to give exactly what most people are predicting, a hard-headed partisan attack on the Democrats. He will use this as a campaign platform, and it certainly won't bolster what people think of the State of the Union. But for him, this is something of a victory, because I think there was a sense of humiliation when Speaker Pelosi wouldn't allow him to do this in the middle of the government shutdown. It won't move the needle. It won't really persuade anyone who is not supportive of him to support him. So I doubt there'll be any huge effect from what he says.
Do you think all of the back and forth, all this bluster, will actually make people watch it more? Or are we expecting this to be, we're definitely not expecting Super Bowl numbers around this, right?
I think people have seen a lot of President Trump. And in some ways, I think his constant appearances everywhere, from television to social media, will probably undercut how interested people are in turning on to see him speak during the State of the Union.
Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Over the course of the partial government shutdown, we talked a lot on this show about who lost money. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates that the shutdown cost the economy $11 billion. That's nearly twice what the president wanted for the border wall. And then there were the more personal costs to the hundreds of thousands of federal workers, some of who we heard from directly, who missed paychecks. But some people made money off of the government shutdown. Between December 22nd, the first day of the shutdown, and Friday, the last day, shares for pawnbroker chains like EZCorp and First Cash jumped more than 18%. And for a handful of companies providing payday loans and other consumer credit, stocks surged 23% over the course of the shutdown. Now, that's likely a short-term boost for these companies, but the people who turned to these predatory loans could be paying them off for far longer. Mayersa Baradaran is a professor of law at the University of Georgia and the author of How the Other Half Banks. Mayersa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about payday loans. These are short-term loans. They're small amounts of cash, and they're usually given to folks at really high interest rates. Can you give us a sense of how those interest rates compare to, say, you know, regular interest rates from a bank?
Yeah, I mean, they're astronomical compared to a bank. I mean, a bank, you know, a mortgage from a bank is about a 6% APR to 10% APR. Even subprime gets, you know, something like 10, 15%. These payday loans are somewhere between 300 to 2,000% APR. Now, they're not meant to be taken out as a long-term loan product like a mortgage, but, you know, they turn into longer-term products than they are intended to be. They're intended to be to sort of cover a gap between one, you know, paycheck to another, and you're using your next paycheck as collateral on the loan, although they're not fully securitized. But you're expecting a paycheck to come in 2 weeks, but you have sort of more month than you have money. And so you take out a payday loan, you're supposed to pay it back. But the research shows that about 80% of people that take out a payday loan end up rolling it over, meaning they take it out for more than one cycle. And so those fees and interest rates add up really, really quickly. And so by the end of the day, you've ended up paying not just, you know, the $500, let's say, loan that you've taken out, but something like, you know, $1,500 to $2,000 in just interest and fees.
And that's for a typical loan of about how much? You're paying $2,000 interest on a loan that you took out for how much?
I mean, these loans range from, you know, anywhere between like $500 to $2,000. They're small loans. They're meant to cover, you know, the basic necessities or little things like that.
One of the other types of businesses that made money off of this were the pawnbrokers. How do they factor in? How do pawnbrokers factor into this equation?
I mean, there's a whole range of sort of non-bank lenders here. You've got pawn, payday, title loans. All of these things are varieties of the same thing. And what pawn is you're bringing in a product of value. So your, you know, wedding ring, your laptop, something like that. And they're giving you a loan and they're holding on to this piece of property as collateral. It's not about the ring or the laptop. They don't really want to resell that. That's just there in case you default. What the business model of these lenders is the interest and fees that you're paying on the loan itself. So the pawnbroker is sort of taking something from you just in case you default. That's same thing with title loans. So title loans is they take the title to your car. So in the event that you don't pay back the loan and all the fees and interest, they're able to take your car over. Payday is there is nothing as collateral, but they can, you know, garnish wages and things like that.
Let's talk about who's taking out these loans. I mean, we're talking about this. Obviously, there was a spike during the government shutdown. We did extensive reporting here on the show about how families were struggling to get by. Many American families are living paycheck to paycheck, can't afford to take a couple weeks without pay. But generally speaking, beyond what we see in the shutdown, who is the target demographic, if any, for this type of product?
I mean, these are, to quote sort of politicians, the average American. This is not this is not the destitute. You have to have a paycheck. You have to have an income to take out a payday loan. And so the Federal Reserve did this study. About half of the American population, if they needed, if they had a shortfall of about, you know, $1,000, they would have to borrow to make ends meet. So if you needed $1,000, let's say if you're a furloughed federal employee who doesn't have a ton of savings, which is the case for most Americans because we're just not making enough wages to meet our expenses, you would have to borrow that money because you're not getting paid. And so some of us can go to friends and family to borrow. Some of us can have some other, you know, means of getting that income. But that's complicated on its own, right? Friends and family, there's other sort of complexities that come with borrowing.
Well, there are. And I want to bring in one more voice here because we're talking about the complications of that. Let's take a listen to what our Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross had to say about this issue.
The banks and the credit union should be making credit available to them. Now, true, the people might have to pay a little bit of interest, but the idea that it's paycheck or zero is not a really valid idea.
Marissa, I want to sort of break that down because that's the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, A, telling people to take out loans for, quote, a little bit of interest, and that the idea of not having a paycheck, it's paycheck or nothing, is not valid. Let's be realistic. How valid is that comment?
That is a shocking level of ignorance of how banks and credit unions work. I mean, banks and credit unions haven't been able to give consumer loans or haven't been interested in giving consumer loans since like the 1900s. It is impossible to walk into your bank and ask for a $500 loan to cover your next paycheck. Banks just aren't in that business anymore. And so people like Wilbur Ross and others who live sort of, people of means who have a ton of money saved in the bank or, you know, have other people that they can rely on, don't understand what it's like to be poor. They assume that these banks can just do it and that payday loans, you know, that's people are going there because they're just making bad decisions. I mean, why would someone go to a payday lender and pay 300% interest if their bank was able to give them a loan for less?
I always say it takes money to make money, but it also takes money to get money, right, at a fair interest rate in this country.
Yeah, I mean, banks like to lend to people who don't need it. And banks like to lend larger loans. They like to lend mortgage loans and business loans and things like that. They're not in the business of lending consumer loans. That's where payday and pawn and title loans come in. And they're doing it at a very, very high rate of interest.
Marissa Baradaran is a professor of law at the University of Georgia. Marissa, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.